Okay, this is Lindsay Krause, and I am teaching a class called The God Within at Wisdom's Heart Center. This is May 20th, 2013.
Doing your voice over there?
Yeah, that's right. I'm getting ready to record my answering machine message. What I want to do, kind of throughout the summer, and if there's any more days open, I will tap Margaret and Jesse and everybody to see if I can teach some more. I think that we're at a very critical moment on the earth. There's a wonderful article in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago about the fact that we reached a level of carbon dioxide greater than has been known in the existence of humanity and millions of years before even. We're not doing it right. We are having a real problem. We're destroying our mother. It's one of the immediate sins in Buddhism, and it's on every religion's top 10. You don't kill your parents. So I think it's very, very important. Something that a great teacher of mine, Joseph Campbell, who was a great teacher of mythology in the 20th century, said. He said, when the astronauts stood on the moon and they looked back at the Earth, it looked like an oasis in the desert of the universe. It was green, and it looked so vulnerable. It was a little misty, had that layer of protective ozone around it, like a little egg. And they were very moved by the sight of it, and they said, there are no boundaries. You can't see, you know, Afghanistan, and can't see France, and you can't see Italy, right? We have to remember that in studying a spiritual path, there are many nations, there are many languages, there are many cultures, there are many spiritual paths. But basically, the source is the same. The source is the same. It's to live a life of service to others, that's meaningful, that's constructive, that's creative, that's beautiful, to learn how to love so that we can live and die well and happily. Kind of end of sentence. So one of the things that I thought might be important is to look a little bit into the history of some of the separation that happened between East and West, because we are Westerners who have now been attempting to come into an Eastern tradition. And I think, you know, many of us that are in certainly the Sangha that meets here got very fired up about this Buddhism stuff, which is quite wonderful and seems to not interfere with other people's traditions, but in fact enhance it, but is also wonderful in its own right. And sometimes I find myself sitting, saying my Tibetan prayers with my Tibetan image of a deity in front of me. And I think, what am I doing? You know, this isn't my language. Like, these aren't my folks here. Like, who is this deity with the many arms or whatever? This is, I have to acknowledge my lack of familiarity, that I didn't grow up with it, and I go back to my image of the creche or my image of Jesus teaching or the cross or something, and I do a little comparison check-in. You know, am I being honest with myself? You know, as I'm dying, who am I going to call upon here? Whose arms do I want to fall into? And what does this all mean, that I'm doing all these different things? So I think it's time to ask ourselves, for instance, why is it that Buddhism, having been sprung from Tibet and from India, but Tibet especially by the Chinese in 1959, I mean, if the Dalai Lama hadn't had to come over the Himalayas, Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism might be behind those mountains even now. Why did it take hold here? Who are we that we respond so to this? And what is it that we want? And where are we going with it? Because it's a perilous path to adopt a religion from another country or a deep philosophy from another country. We are in the midst of, I think, making some very important decisions as to whose religion is this, after all. Do you know what I mean? So in that light, I think we need to remember some things about the fact that this is one green world, one green vulnerable world, And we're all making our way in it at this moment, which is a tremendous privilege. And that we must use this time to come to terms in ourselves as to where our allegiances lie, what is important in our lives, what comforts us, what inspires us, and what are the things that we feel deep in our bones are true, so that we can feel guided as we go along. I wouldn't want to feel as I was leaving the planet that there was no space for a grandchild, no air, no water, or only, you know, a land full of conflict and cruelty. So in Buddhism, we have the idea that if you are born into this world, you're born into your own context, your own particular situation, which leaves you with a particular set of lenses on that you see the world out of. You can't help it. It's nobody's fault. You just aren't a neutral party. Right? So all of us, in a way, are seeing our own world. We're seeing it according to kind of what we're in denial of, what we want to bring closer, what we want to push farther away. Right? The things that come into our heads that we're barely conscious of, prejudices from our family and our schooling and our et cetera, et cetera. We're taught that, okay? So, in a way you could say, the world is ours to construct creatively. That would be the positive way of saying it. That our seeing our world and living in our world the way we do is a gift, is a contribution, because it's not the life that is like anyone else's. It's our own life. And we are particularly backed in this by our Western traditions. Joseph Campbell's favorite story, I think he feels it's kind of the height of what Western civilization has brought into the world, is the night in the Arthurian legend when Arthur is in his court and all the knights are there and the Grail appears, veiled, hanging in the air, and everyone in the room knows it, and they see it, and then it disappears. And he had made a rule for his knights that no one would eat dinner unless someone had had an adventure. And because they were all going on adventures, everybody was eating rather well. Yeah. But because they had sat down to dinner and hadn't eaten, and there was no story of adventure, there was just this appearance of the Grail, one of the knights stood up and said, "I propose that all of us go on a quest to find the Grail and to lift the veil." And so they went off the next morning, and they felt that they would be ashamed to go off in a group on a road that was already laid out for them. And so it's written in the story that they spread out on the road and each of them turned their horses into the woods and entered into the woods, into the dark, by a path that was of their own making. So that's the romantic sense of longing, the lone wolf, the cowboy, the independent woman or man in the West that takes up the challenge and goes on the quest themselves. And this is the hero's journey, according to Campbell, which is a universal one all over the earth. But in the East, they handle it a bit differently. We, in particular, have brought this flavor of one person alone looking for that thing which can't be articulated, to uncover it, to discover it, to find it for yourself, to descend into the darkness, go into the forest, the forest of unknown experience, the forest of original experience, which is something that we never do. I'll never forget, I went to I don't know what you call them, they're like a camp that everybody goes riding for hundreds and hundreds of miles. I can't remember what you call those, a dude ranch or something. Someone took me to a dude ranch. And I realized, growing up in New York City and in Massachusetts, I had never been off-road in my entire life. I mean, I'd go walking on trails. but I had never been where I could not see a road. And it was an entirely different experience of living, of being. When you are without reference points, right? When you feel lost, and, you know, the Pope steps down, or you feel lost, you know, something isn't doing it for you. You can't find, whether you're turning to the Bible or to the Koran or to the, you know, Buddhist sutras or whatever, or to a teacher. You are thrown on yourself, and that's a really good thing, because that's where your teacher is going to throw you ultimately anyway. You know, the teaching in Buddhism is that the texts and the teachings are a raft, and as you get there, you're going to throw the raft away. Because in almost every religion, the ultimate is not something that is a conceptual experience. It's not something that is known. So something that is known will help us arrive there until the final point where we hopefully can become the thing that we don't recognize yet as ourselves. Okay? So, because this is kind of a perilous moment, I think, in time, I don't think any of us have a sense of what our country is, the way our parents did, or our grandparents did, or my school, or, you know, I'm in uniform, and, you know, God is on our side. You know, all of these kinds of reference points that our parents had, that our grandparents had, fighting World War II, fighting World War I, whatever, throughout history, I don't think we live inside those reference points anymore. I don't think there are horizons. There's no frontier, although this country keeps looking for one. You can't build any more buildings in New York City, but they don't know that. You literally can't move in New York City anymore. It's unbelievable to experience it, having grown up there. Can't walk down the street anymore. You're like this, constant. I'm sorry, excuse me, you're moving back and forth, like Tokyo. And they're just, you know, you see them building more and more. We don't know. We're not looking ahead. We're not looking ahead with any kind of constraint, real planning, or wisdom. And that means as individuals, about the next day, or as a country, or as a world, about the next decades. So I think it's very important that we look back for a moment at this split between East and West. So we take a look a little bit as to how we came here and what these two systems of thought might mean to us. And then I thought I would say something about mythology itself, because I think that we have mythic images that are attached to the religions that we grow up in, and we have mythic images in this room, and we need to have a relationship to them. And every age needs to create its new own mythology. And we are in an age that is unlike any other. I mean, mythologies of old had many things in common, like the sky being a cup, you know, heaven versus earth. Well, we've stood a man on the moon. The moon has been historically a potent deity. And we've got a guy up there, right, walking around in the dust. That's a shock. You know, where's the rabbit? You know, the moon has a different feeling for us. It really does. I mean, to me it does now. It's a little bit, the bloom is a little bit off the rose for me, because someone's been up there on the moon. And, you know, so there's been heaven and earth. But our own modern physics says that every particle, including every particle in your body, is a hologram of the entire universe. It's like the acorn to the oak tree, that it contains everything that it would take to create an entire universe. Our own physics is talking about this, and I'm not talking about 5 minutes ago. I'm talking about a little while ago. Physics came up with that one, the holographic universe. You know, things are a lot stranger than we think. And we need to catch up a bit in our own thinking. We're still a little bit mired I think, especially in this country, in Genesis, which is a great story. Okay? But now that we are living in a cosmos, you know, that's a lot closer than it used to be, and in many ways more comprehensible than it used to be in all of its incomprehensibility. And we need a mythology of one world, at least, and not to be so worried about who thinks what and who said what about, you know, a deity with many arms, or is there one, or was the world made in 4,000 days? We got to grow up a little bit out of that and really think, who are our deities? Who are we in relation to them? So, our races are pretty late arrivals in the human species, and we've moved very, very fast. And in a way, I think we've moved so fast in the last 50-100 years that we kind of need to take a breath. We are all so inundated, don't you feel? Just totally inundated. We have no time because we don't know how to make time. We don't know how to take time. We are constantly responding. So we're constantly reactive. And it's extremely stressful on the entire system. So we can't really think our own thoughts. So we don't know very well who we are in a very simple, foundational way that more primitive peoples, I think, might have had a better hold on for themselves, whether we think that what they believed in is true or not. So, the break between the West and the East, you could make a line down what used to be called Persia. And you could say that on one side of that line is China, Japan, the Far East. You could say that on the other side is the Middle East or the Levant, Europe, the United States, the West. So east of that line are two creative high culture centers. India is also included that, and the Far East. Civilizations with literacy and writing and architecture, art, music. West of that line, there's also creative high culture centers, right? Egypt, Europe, the Levant, as they call it, and all of us. So the two eastern domains, historically, were very, very isolated from each other and everyone else. India by the Himalayas and the oceans, and China by the great deserts and the great oceans surrounding China. So new influences never came to those places in really massive force. They've come in gradually, and they've been assimilated into the culture that was already there. But the European and the Near Eastern civilizations, domains, are in immediate and constant contact. There were great arteries of transportation. There were the great rivers, Mediterranean, the Black Sea, etc., the Nile. Historically, there were two very important invading peoples, the northern nomadic hunting and fighting people called the Aryans. They came down into the European high culture from the grass plains of northern Europe, and the other equally belligerent tribes, as Joseph Campbell calls them, the Semite tribes, who swept into the river plains of the Levant from what they called the Syro-Arabian Desert. These invasions continually disturbed the existing cultural patterns. The Occident, the West, had a history of disintegration and reintegration. Sound familiar? In other words, progress, where you have numbers of people influencing each other, they're coming to collision a great many contrary ideas, and they have to fight it out. We live in a country that literally is the culmination of that. Our Statue of Liberty articulates that very well. Basically says, bring me everyone and we'll deal with you. And we are not having an easy time doing that. So, so when one turns from the Western world with the complex philosophies that grew up from all of these ideas coming together, to the East, you get a sense of going, he says, where there's only one kind of vegetation. There's only a few essential themes that run through the whole system that have been there for an extremely long time. When did the high culture forms enter the domains of India and the Far East? Indian cultural tradition begins in the Indus Valley civilization around 2500 BC. Culture in the Far East in China begins with the Shang Dynasty around 1600 BC. And both of those dates are within the Bronze Age, a long, long time ago. Development in the high culture in the Near East, Mesopotamia and Egypt, started around 8000 BC with agriculture, animal husbandry. Before that, everybody lived basically by gathering berries and hunting. In the 4th millennium BC, in the 3000s, in the Tigris and Euphrates valleys, the birth of civilization, I can hear my 6th grade teacher say, you find relatively large, complicated cities like Sumer, Ur, Akkad. During this time, writing, mathematical calculation, astronomical observation, and tax collecting were invented. See, not everything about the city is that great. Kings arose. Professions were created. When you stop being busy all the time just trying to get a meal, you can actually perfect something. The priests in these cultures recognized that the planets moved at mathematically calculable rates through the fixed stars, and this idea produced a totally new view of the universe, cosmic regularity. The notion rested on the idea that the cosmos is not ruled by a personal god. An impersonal power moves with irresistible regularity in the courses of the rise and fall of the day and night, the waxing and waning of the moon, and the coming and going of the year. These ideas inspired the Bronze Age myths and the Bronze Age civilizations. And civilizations are based on the myths that were gathered by a group of people to help them basically live, to help them get through the phases of life that we have in common with every human being that has ever lived on the earth, with youth and adulthood and old age, and dying. The Chinese Tao, the Indian idea of the Dharma, the Egyptian Ma'at, the Sumerian Mei, these are all images in these religions of an impersonal cosmic order within which the deities function as bureaucrats. These gods are not the controlling agencies. The controlling agency has no personality whatsoever. They personify the forces of nature. These forces also operate within you, in your nature, because you are part of nature. The mythology of a people presents a grand poetic image and refers past itself to principles that are mysterious and ineffable. So, myth began to arise with four basic functions: to open the mind of everybody in the society to the mystery domain, the mystery dimension that cannot be analyzed or talked about, but can only be experienced as out there and in here all at once. Two, to present an image of the universe that connects the transcendent world to the world of everyday experience. Three, to present a social order by which people will be coordinated with that mystery. So, the king was seen as the sun, radiating light. His crown represented the sun or the moon. Often the moon was used, right, as a headdress, the horns symbolizing time, because the moon comes up as that crescent and then gets larger, waxes and wanes, helps us record the time, the months going by. The bull also has those horns, and they shed them periodically, and then they grow again through time. His court is in hierarchic levels, like the planets. And some of those ministers actually wore the costumes of the insignia of the planets. Four, to carry the individual through the stages of life, childhood dependence, adult responsibility, old age, and death. So the great cosmos and the individual and the order of society are all one great unit pulled together by the myths of that culture, pointing to the mystery dimension, that thing which is unknown, that mystery that keeps us in this room all the time. Why are we here? How incredible to be alive and not know why. How incredible to be here every day and not know what our purpose is in being here, or who's doing what, or how it all happened anyway. Right? Even our physicists are still looking, intelligent and extraordinary as they are. We are all looking. So if you ask, is God merciful or just? Does he love me? Does he love my people more than other people? Am I not chosen? Are they not rejected? This is kindergarten stuff from the Eastern point of view. All right? It's not personal, in other words, from their point of view. In Occidental and Western theology, the word transcendent is used to mean outside of the world. In other words, we are in relationship to a God that we envision in the sky, in heaven, in the clouds, higher than we are. In the East, the idea, the forms of sensibilities of time and space, all of these are functions of human thought. The mystery that you are talking about is coming from your conceptual thought. So this is very, very seriously taken. So the absolute is absolutely transcendent of all thought, but your ability to conceive of it is coming from you. So you are very much part of the whole. In the West, it's you versus God. It's you in relationship to something outside of you. Okay, let me go over that. I think I'm not being clear. Am I being clear? I'm not going to let you into the Apollo Theater. Yeah, Lindsay, you're being clear. Or no, that's not clear. I mean, like, huh? I think it's not clear.
One more time.
Okay. In the East, transcendent is outside of thought. All right? But the latter is your own thinking. The impersonal aspect of the cosmology meant that they were able, in a way, to take a step back, right? They were able to say, we are part of nature. This is part of nature, and there's an order to it. In the West, the word transcendent is not, it's in a different relationship to us. It's outside of the world. It's not included in the natural world that we are a part of and our thinking is a part of. Okay? In the East, it's outside of thought. But through our own thought, we can reach it. In other words, nature will take us there. Think of Catholicism and of original sin. Nature's not going to take you there. Nature's going to take you in the other direction. Right? Okay? Outside of the world. So, in the West, to imagine that your definitions of God have anything to do, that your definitions of your God have anything to do with the ultimate mystery, is a form of idolatry. So, a God from this point of view is conceived by people in different ways, and they have different relationships with it. In the East, the idea of a deity is more impersonal, less personal. The fundamental theological thought here is that only God can know God. In Christianity, this is handled by the Trinity. Right? In order to know the Father, one must oneself be God, and that's the role that Christ played, was to come down and act as an intermediary so that through him one could arrive at some kind of relationship with God, some kind of godhood yourself, some kind of Christhood yourself. And the story of his life shows the way. So you are looking to know Christ in order to know God. In the East, that which is transcendent of all knowledge is the basis of your being. Tat svam asi, thou art that. You yourself are that which you would know. But they say in Buddhism, when you become a Buddha, they won't call you by your name. The person that you are identifying with now is not that. But they say your nature, the nature of your own mind, which is a lot larger in every kind of scale than we think it is what we're talking about, the purity of your own mind. They say we just need to remove obscurations. It's clean, like a mirror. It's totally clean, like a clean glass. We have to clean it up. We have to remove the obscurations. This is the mystery of the East. So, A is you, X is the mystery, and A equals X, but X is not the person you think you are now. Okay? Maybe that makes it easier. The one you think you are is not it, and the one you can't even think about yet is it. Now compare this with the traditions that have come out of the Near East. Judaism, Christianity, Islam. Here, God created the world. So, creator and creature are distinct. Right? So, to say I am it is fundamental blasphemy. Both the mystic Sufi Al-Hallaj and Christ were tortured on the cross, one for having said I am it, and the other for saying the Father and I are one. It's against the rules. It's against the rules. Luther was one of the first people in Christianity to begin to protest this idea, to say, I don't need a priest. I don't need to buy an indulgence to get from purgatory to heaven. I'm running on my own steam here, and I'm going to make my own relationship. But it's still a relationship, right? There's still God in his heaven and all of us down here. So in the West, we're in exile from God. We can only achieve a relationship with X. Our religions seek a relationship to God, not an experience of identity with the divine. Now, I'm talking basically here, okay? Because all of us are working very hard to achieve an identity with the divine. And in many churches, of course, people are looking to try and take on as many aspects of a kind of divine goodness as they can. So I'm talking in a kind of big picture here. But it's important because this is in us from the time that we're children, and we have to recognize it and understand it. So in Judaism, God has a covenant with certain people. How do you achieve a membership in the group? You're being born to a Jewish mother. This is, I hope, shifting. And by honoring a covenant in one's life. In Christianity, Christ is true God and true man. In the East, that's the point everyone has to realize about themselves. Okay? Christ is related to us through his humanity, and he relates us to God through his divinity. So we become related to Christ through baptism into his church, as in Judaism, through a social institution. In Islam, the relationship to Allah is through the law, the Quran, and through his prophet Muhammad. So when a Muslim bows to the east 5 times in a day, it's not toward where God is, but toward where the law was passed down to Muhammad by God. Islam itself means submission. One submits not to something intrinsic in oneself, but to the might of Allah and His law. So in the Western traditions, the faithful are dependent upon social institutions, the chosen people, the mother church, and the law. These institutions have put forward pretty exorbitant claims for themselves. And we face a lot of doubt and a lot of disequilibrium. Our own transcendentalists here in New England in the 19th century began to realize what Buddhism and Hinduism were saying. And they became fascinated with the Celtic religions, the Roman religions, and the Greek religions, where there was an idea of the sacred grove. There was a relation to a sanctified local place, nature within and without. In these traditions, mythology was not an account of pseudo-historical facts that are supposed to have happened somewhere long ago, but each myth is a poetic revelation of the mystery of that which is now and forever within your being. In other words, when the Romans came in contact with the Celts, they began to integrate some of the beautiful Celtic traditions. You know, our mistletoe comes from that. Their ideas that nature, that sexuality, that the seasons, that cyclical time, that there were other worlds than the world that you are looking at when you look at a tree, when you look at a rock. Our own Native Americans, which I think we would do well to look into how they treated nature and their environment, had extraordinary things to say about this. To me, this kind of mysticism is something that we're attracted to in the Eastern religions. We are attracted to the idea of the world being so magical. If you read a book like Autobiography of a Yogi, it's an extraordinary experience. I really recommend the CDs, because the feeling of the atmosphere in India, which was filled with yogis, with people, you know, doing magical things, with people speaking in magical ways. It was just what they breathed and ate for breakfast. We can't even imagine living in a society like that. We are extremely flat-footed and scientific and literal. And I think we have, in a way, lost a relationship to the natural world, being as technology fanatical as we are, living in huge cities, whirling around at the speed of light ourselves. We rarely even look up at the sky, and the weather to us is just a pain in the neck. You know, it's interfering with our flight. So, the first most important stage of the branching off was seen in the Near East, where the earliest god kings and their courts used to be ritually entombed. In Sumer, around 2300 BC, the king became no longer a god, but a servant of the god, supervisor of the race of human beings created to serve the gods. Not identity, but relationship was the paramount concern. Man had been made not to be a god, but to know, honor, and serve him. So that the king, who had earlier been the embodiment of a divinity on earth, and at the height of his power, would pass the power along and would literally, ritually entomb himself and the rest of the court, was now but a priest offering a sacrifice to one above, not a god returning himself in sacrifice to a god who is himself. The new mythology brought forth, in due time, a development away from the earlier review and view of returning cycles. So, instead of the cyclical, impersonal cosmos, with the king as the sun, the court as the planets, right? We have now a progressive, temporally oriented mythology, linear time, not cyclical, ever-returning, beginningless time, a creation date, once and for all, this is when the earth was created, a beginning of time and a subsequent fall predicted, a subsequent end of time as we know it, and a work of restoration still in progress. Okay? The world was no longer to be known as a mere showing in time of the paradigms of eternity, but as a field of unprecedented cosmic conflict between two powers, one light and one dark. Along came Zoroaster and posited God and the devil, the wise lord Ahura Mazda, and the evil principle Angra Mainyu. This is really, really different. So this is very familiar to us, and Zoroaster had much to do with what we have ended up in our laps with in terms of Christianity. Because in the Eastern traditions, we are not involved in a battle of right versus wrong or God versus the devil. They say that because we are all born into this particular context and see the world out of our own particular lenses, we are the creators of the world that we see. There is no standard issue world, like a movie set, out there apart from us that we step onto when we're born. Because who would have the objective mind to describe that world to everybody so that we could all have it in common and interpret it? There is no such mind anywhere. It's all each person's view. That would make the world a projection or a reflection of our own thinking, of our own perceptions. If that is true, then everything, pleasure and pain, good and bad, God and the devil, are all of our own making. And in that sense, they are the same. The origin is the same. They're all part of one system. Fighting the devil is fighting yourself. Right? So fighting evil, that thing which we have, we're still propounding it. You know, whether it's Iraq, or whether it was World War II, or whether it was World War I, or the Spanish-American War, we need to grow beyond the idea that there are other human beings that are evil. We need to grow beyond the old mythologies that might have posited a projection of our own hatred in another group. It's the green, vulnerable world, and we are all the same. We are all the same. If a piece of news can go around the internet in a second, how can we really continue to rail about our differences? We are going to get closer and closer and closer and closer. I mean, didn't everybody feel they had some involvement in the revolution in Egypt? It didn't seem like such a local event. You felt that you could blog. You felt that you could email. You felt that you could see it, hear it, be there. You know, put your name on a list. Right, our own government is operating this way. MoveOn.org appears to be running part of the government. You know, but it's incredible because other than the 60s, for the very first time, I feel I'm a bit more informed. Right? In the moment. This bill is coming up. What do you want to say? What do you want to do? You want to be part of this? You want to not be part of this? Put your name here and put your money where your mouth is right now, or we're not going to get this done. It's an awesome thing. It's like being an arm of the government, and the arm can work, you know? This is a different kind of mythology. This is not the Sun King. This is not the impersonal Sun King, right? This is our good old American system, and that image of the many arms, you know, of those deities in the East. You know, my dear Lama said to me when I said, you know, what are those things? Anyway, they're beautiful, and it's amazing that the sculptors can get them all attached to the back. But what are they doing? You know, because they all have these strange weapons and bloody heads and everything. And he said, basically, as you grow in compassion, you get more capable. You know, whether you have to bust somebody's chops with a, you know, iron fork, or whether, you know, you have to gain some wisdom and, you know, a head dripping blood. Blood has always represented life. Blood has always represented the essence, right? And in Buddhism, it's the essence of wisdom. It's the essence of understanding that the world is your projection, that you have everything to do with what you see. Nothing doesn't have your name on it. You know, so all you need all of these things, all of these arms. And they say as you grow. It's 45 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, I will finish my sentence and then. Thank you very, very much.
That's
what
that was.
Yeah. I love it, it's great.
So one of the things that we have to come to terms with in saying this about the time of the change, because we have put a man on the moon, because we are in a leadership position in terms of our physics and, well, not for very long, but anyway, we're in a leadership position basically and have been for a while, in terms of our ability to see through a lot of the scientific basis of the universe, we have to think out, do we believe, right, in a heaven and an earth separation anymore? Is that useful to us? When we say divine, what does that mean? Where is it? Is it external to us? Are we holding our own development at bay when we think so? Is it some fantasy of projection that we haven't even really thought about? I was reading in a book of Thich Nhat Hanh's recently something that just has really moved me, where he said, what kind of God would hold out a paradise that you could not imagine? Yeah. Oh my God, it makes me cry. That's the tenderest thought I ever heard. Of course not. Of course we must be able to imagine it. Human consciousness is so extraordinary, and the Tibetans and the Indians and those in the East that develop the technology of the inner world, the mind, while we were, you know, making the, you know, cotton gin. Like, you know, no blame. I'm glad, you know, I couldn't have a t-shirt without it. But, you know, they were doing something else, and we haven't got a clue about how extraordinary the accomplishments were that they made alone in caves or in the woods for years and years and years, exploring the huge cosmos inside their heads. We need this knowledge at this point in time, and I think we have a sense that we do, because we are beginning to see that our own technology is not making us as happy or giving us the leisure time that we thought. We are more stressed than probably any American generation, other than perhaps the revolutionaries, who didn't have an easy time of it. But we do not seem to have any time at all. We are so hassled. We are so bombarded. Right? And we're pretty confused about even how to conduct our own day. We don't even know how to close the computer and just say, stop. Just stop. I can't. I just can't respond to that anymore. Right? We have no quiet. We have no peace. And we you know, I've really explored this in myself. Like, is it the ego that just can't bear not to be in the action? You know, like, I might miss something if I'm not on a machine. If you walk around, it's really frightening. If you go to New York, you really, really see it because there's so many people. Nobody's looking at each other. Nobody's looking up. In a restaurant, at the table, nobody's looking at each other. You can look around the room and every face is looking down at a phone. You know, it's not that the phones are bad. That's not what I'm trying to say. You just have to ask yourself, what is your experience of living? Because it seems to me the only reason to have a spiritual path at all is for your experience of living to be superb, really wonderful, really loving, really warm, really close to other people. Because it's only through serving other people that you're going to be happy. There's nothing in the phone, really, that's helping you other than contact with another person. And what is the quality of that contact? You know, bullets. Isn't it interesting that we call them bullets? You know, we have to look at these things. What is the quality, you know, when you are going like this with your remote control and you get to channel 827, really? I do this at night with my mom, who hasn't got the eyesight to read but can see a little bit of television. I'm looking for some sweet little movie. And we're, you know, we're up in the 900s. And I'm going, what has happened to us? What has happened to us? What are we doing? So, it seems to me that in, and I promise you, I will give you a break in 1 second, that in this green and vulnerable place, we need to ratchet down really hard on ourselves and say, you know, this life goes by very, very, very quickly. Very quickly. Seems to go by faster and faster the older you get, doesn't it? It's just zooms by. And I asked myself, why does it go by more slowly when I was a child? And I really think it was because I was not thinking ahead. I was right there. I was just right there. And I remember so well because I had a beautiful childhood in this place on Cape Ann. Annie was with me for some of it, and there are a number of people that I knew growing up here. And, you know, we were sitting in the choke cherries, you know, in some bramble, just having a great time, you know, or jumping into the quarry until our bathing suit straps broke, and that was the excitement of the summer, you know. Or just shuffling around, you know, just feeling the rocks on our bare feet and developing those good calluses and just smelling the seaweed. We were really, really present to our lives at that point. I know, because my memories are so vivid of it. And it seems to me that presence is the most important thing that's required of us. And it's really required. Rachel Carson, you know, in her wonderful, wonderful book that really began the ecology movement, said, all you need to notice is your own backyard. You will see the changes that are happening there. You don't need to be in the observatories. Just right there. That you will know what you have to do. Meaning that the world is holographic. Everything that is local to you, your world is local to you. Your universe is local to you because it's a projection of yours. It's all your family. That's a really beautiful idea. And I think the idea of the East, of the impersonal cosmos, in a way, has come to the West to be refined. To be refined by the fact that we have this marvelous relationship, like the Knights of the Round Table, with the forest of original experience. We will go alone, each one of us. right? Each one of us. We don't have to wait for the ancestors to approve, right? We have this idea that as individuals we can make our own decisions, and we can. We can enter the forest, each in our own way, and bring that gift of the world that we're projecting. It doesn't have to be a problem. It doesn't have to be an isolationist problem. We can just keep offering, like the hero that goes out on the quest. We can bring that boon that we find, and we bring back, and begin to teach each other what it is that we have to offer, right? And create a relationship with our own divine being, because the God that we project out is our own divine being. It can only be coming from there. Where else would it be coming from? We only know it here. So being in relationship to the God and being the God are the same thing. And, you know, I'll read you some poems from this guy. You know, every great religious poet has said it. You know, you will come back to where you started from and know the place for the first time. It's, you are the original experience. The knights go out into the forest to have original experiences. Well, what's the definition of an original experience? It's yours. It's original. It can belong to nobody else. If they're on a path described by somebody else, it's not their path. Okay, we'll take a break. All right, we're back. We're better than ever. The more I study and the more I try to practice all of this myself, I have found that it is true that we can know levels of happiness that weren't part of, perhaps, our experience before. And the more that that has been true for me, the more confidence I have had that that can be more and more so. But that the way to it is an odd one. If we can acknowledge that what we see is an act of creativity on our part, that there's no difference between the life of the imagination and what we call, you know, daily thought or our, quote, ordinary perception, that it's all made of whole cloth, made of one thing. That we need to think about our lives as a work of art. You design a work of art. You make preliminary sketches. You set things up right. You do everything you can to make sure that it will be in place once it's done. You make sure chemically with your paints that they're not going to fall apart or disappear. You make sure there's an armature in your sculpture so it won't implode once you have it standing in some public plaza. You prepare. You think ahead. And from the time you begin, even the moment before you begin, you have an odd sensation that sometimes you're conscious of and sometimes you're not quite conscious of, but it's the same sensation. You're grateful for everything that's ever happened to you in your life. Because it's what you have to bring to the party. You feel like, I have a right to make this mark because I'm a human being and I have lived and there's something for me in my hand here to say. You may not even know what that is yet, but the fact that you feel you have a right to make the mark, you're qualified. You know, even if everything that's happened has been a disaster, this is what it feels like to be an actor, for sure. You're thrilled with the disasters because it made you qualified, you know, to show what human suffering is like and to be true on the stage. We should think about this in our lives because one of the reasons why we tear ourselves apart so badly, why we have such bad opinions of ourselves, is that we think we've ruined our lives. We think we've wasted our lives. We think we've blown it and other people are doing so well. We should take note from the artist that any moment that we're going to be about to make something in the world, which is usually a relationship, even if we're just saying hi to the postman, that is the most important thing that we're doing. That is high art. If we have the thought, how lovely that person looks, don't they have extraordinary eyes? The choice of color in their scarf is extraordinary. Let it come out of your mouth. Just shower someone with some sweet thought that you're having and don't hold on to it. Make the mark. Right? What kind of art do you want to make? The minute you begin to make the mark, you will be grateful for everything that happened to you up to that moment that gave you the guts to do it a little bit differently today. To start to realize that the beauty is in your hands. It's a reflection of you. What you make of that moment. The moment is just a kind of potential. It's a field of potential. You are either going to bring the track record of everything, you know, all the luggage from the past into that moment and create it kind of like a monster, the way they used to do in the 19th century. They thought if they, you know, just created a Frankenstein and then electrified him, he would walk and talk. We do that. We kind of vivify our thoughts all the time, drag them over the moment, and then things become quite ordinary. They become just like yesterday and like the day before and the day before. It isn't life that's like that. Life is new. You really get that when you have a baby and you look down and you just go, oh my God, this is brand new. This is a new chance. That's always there. You can bring yourself to birth all the time. That's why they call them born-again Christians. You can, it's the realization of a baptism that can be happening over and over and over. And personal responsibility is very interesting. The word responsibility goes back to a Greek word, spondi, and spondein in German. Spondi is actually a metrical foot. What they call a metrical foot, I love that expression, in poetry, a beat, two long beats, right? A foot, like planting your foot, and planting it again, like saying out loud, you know? And it began to mean a libation, a sacrifice, an offering. It's interesting to me that the idea of language having weight, having an influence, would then come into being an actual offering. That responsibility is responde. It means to offer again, and to offer again, and to offer again. This could be our life. This could be the song of our life. A continual offering. And, you know, in the theater, when they say that you play a character, you never really do that. It's so interesting. You don't play a character. How would you know who that character is? And how could you play them anyway? It's only you up there. People say to me, oh, it must be wonderful to be an actress. I would just love to be somebody else. And I think, well, that's really interesting because I'm in the dressing room at 8 o'clock at night. You know, there isn't anybody else there. Sometimes I wish they would show up. It's only an aspect of me. But what creates the character is a choice of action, is a choice of what the person in the play is doing. There's no one doing it but me, but there's a selecting out of the doing. And there'll be a certain number of actions that I will play in a play, one for each scene. It's back to Aristotle, unity of time, action, and place. One action for each scene. It's the thing that the playwright has underneath the words, because our words don't have any inherent meaning. There can be a million meanings for a word. They're just decibels. But the intention, what's really going on when it's the fight scene and you know it's the love scene. If the actor is not playing an action that's loving, the play will be lost. This is who we really are. We are playing these actions, and how we select out for the actions that we play will result in a kind of chimera of a character. Other people will string them together. The way we string words together and we say, ah, the sentence means this. Other people will say, ah, Ophelia. Ophelia is kind, or Ophelia is this, or Ophelia is that. And I'm just performing certain actions, and the audience and I have Ophelia hanging in the air between us. They know Ophelia isn't in the room. The game is there, the ritual is there, so that we can have an experience together. You can, at any point in your life, create whatever the heck character you wish to be. This is the trajectory of any spiritual path. If you choose to follow the actions of a deity, one day, and I can vouch for this because it's happened to me on the stage, one day, after weeks and months of preparing and rehearsing and rehearsing and rehearsing, in an atmosphere of generosity, with my focus on another person in the scene with me, wanting something for them, trying to get my attention off myself, out of my mouth will come the voice of the character. I will move. It will be the movement of the character. And all of a sudden, I know it. And I am witness to it, is all I can say. And everybody in the room knows it, and everybody in the room speaks of it in divine terms. People backstage, you know, your hair, everybody's hair is up on their arms, or there's one of those incredible silences in an audience where you all know that the truth is in the room, and you're all just really glad to be there. And an actor feels that way. You feel like you can't take credit for it. You're just really pleased that you prepared correctly and that you were open enough to let it come through. This is what can happen. When they talk about Christ being an intermediary, this is what they mean. Christ, the concept Christ, is the Christ in you, is the servant of mankind, is the one that will give everything, including their body, is the one that is the lowest, and puts everyone else as the highest, is the one that lets go of their plan for their life and their plan for their day and allows themselves to be interrupted again and again and again in order to do something for someone else, no matter how small. Then you are on your way to aligning yourself with that person called the intermediary in the Western traditions in order to take on the character of God. And your humanity is linked, is you know, going hand in hand with a man that you read about coming to Earth and doing these extraordinary things that we can hardly believe that anybody can do. But you read autobiography of a yogi, and people in India were doing them all day long. Reversing the directions of rivers and influencing the weather. When we fall in love, you can understand all that stuff very easily. The weather is totally transformed for you. It can be a monsoon, and you're thrilled, you know? You feel cuter when you get wet when you're in love. Not more bedraggled. You're excited to fling your hair back, you know? I mean, everything is different. The entire environment is different. It's easy to understand how miracles get performed. It's a bloody miracle, right? All of it is possible, right? So we have to understand this idea. Once again, if we are born into a particular context, if there is no standard issue world, if the world doesn't exist out there apart from our perception of it, if I can write with a pen and I can drop it on the floor and the dog can see it as a chew toy, there's something fishy about that pen. It's not a pen from its own side. It becomes a chew toy if a dog is dealing with it. And it works as a chew toy because it's empty of being a pen from its own side, having a fixed identity, kind of alive on its own stage, penness. The dog can't write with it. Right? Things do not have a fixed identity. Nothing in the world is anything but a constantly changing, trillion times a second, constantly changing field of energy and information, a potential. So don't ever feel bad about yourself. There's no such thing as a condemned person in a fixed way, or a bad person in a fixed way, or a failed person in a fixed way. Step back into the river. Just step back in. Just start. Just say, let go of the past. Let go. When you are playing scenes in a play, one of the things an actor has to do, if it's a very emotional scene and you've just bawled your eyes out, whatever, there's a blackout, there's a quick change, you go like this, and you got to step into, you know, the playwright saying, the next morning, the sun is streaming through the window, right? And you got to walk into that scene, and you cannot drag the night before with you, right? Or the gig is up, you know, they won't believe you that it's the next morning and the sun is shining in the window. But the audience has experienced what happened the night before with you, and that will not be forgotten. If you let go, it doesn't mean that you are betraying your old wounds. We hang on to them like they are our badge of honor. If they're not useful to your happiness in the moment or to the happiness of another being, step into Act Two. The sun is streaming through the window. Okay? The things that will make you a human being, that have caused you to suffer before, they will always be with you. They will always be in you. Don't keep playing them. Don't keep playing them. All right? Life will be very monotone for you. There's more fun, there's more variety, there's more excitement to be had. Really. Remember that the world that you see will be a reflection of you. So, get creative. Think the night before. What kind of thing could I get up to tomorrow? Who would like what? What would be just the ticket? What would be a stone riot? You know, where could I leave a dollar bill and watch the fun? Where'd this dollar bill come from? Who left this dollar bill here? you know? Like, you know, we have to... Everything is made by us. Everything is made by us. Right? If you feel lonely, be company. Right? Be company. It's all the opposite. Don't look for somebody to be company to you. You be company. Then there's company in the world. Right? It will only be reflected back to you. All right? We could be having so much fun. And it's important. It's important. I mean, you know, you look at the Boston Marathon guys. You know, we don't know. Do we have another day? We don't know whether this isn't the high point right now. Really. We don't know. We have to get very woken up about that. We can't sort of think, well, in another 20 years, you know, I'll start my day by sitting in front of, you know, a lovely table with a flower and bow my head and just say, let me take on the aspects of the character of someone who is wholly good. And let me come up with my mythology, my image of my God, who is a reflection of the purity that is inherent in my mind. And then let me turn my horse into the forest and do it my way and be creative. And the beauty is in my hands today. This is Hafiz, who I love. I promise. Has not the architect love built your heart in a glorious manner? With so much care that it is meant to break if love ever ceases to know all that happens is perfect? And where does anything love has ever known go when your eye and hand can no longer be warmed by its body? So vast a room your soul, every universe can fit into it. Anything you once called beautiful, anything that ever gave you comfort, waits to unite with your arms again. I promise.